Acts 1, Apostleship. The 11th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 5, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
We've been looking at Acts chapter 1. I want to say a few final comments about Acts chapter 1, and then we'll look at the beginning of Acts 2 today. Rather than review a whole lot, I'm just going to kind of take off where we left off last week in the questions. We talked a little bit about what makes an apostle an apostle, and you'll recall I distinguished three different kinds of apostles that you find in the New Testament. Jesus is called an apostle of God in the book of Hebrews. You have a number of people, or a handful of people, I should say, who are called apostles, but it's pretty clear that they're apostles of churches. So the apostles sent out by the church at Antioch, for example. And that they're really not apostles in the sense that we're interested, in the sense that we're thinking of apostles. They're more like what we would call missionaries, just people who the church has sent out to do evangelistic work on behalf of that church to other people, and they have sent them out. As you may know, apostle comes from the Greek word apostolos, which is related to the Greek word apostello, which simply means to send someone, but it normally has a connotation of delegating them to represent you, delegating them to speak for you. So a government official in that time, the emperor of the empire, might send an apostolos to someone, really delegating him the authority to make a decision on his behalf. So it has all the authority of the emperor, but it's not the emperor personally making the decision. That's sort of the nuance of the particular word. Well, churches could do that. You know, they could send someone to somebody and proclaim the gospel as that church understood it, and they have the authority to speak for them. But when Jesus, when Jesus selected some people to be apostles, they were speaking for him. Jesus wasn't personally teaching his teaching, but these men were given the authority to explain Jesus' teaching and proclaim Jesus' teaching in his stead, and they had the authority to do that. Well, it's the apostles of Jesus Christ that we're most interested in. And I suggested that I think when you put all the information together, you can boil it down to basically four criteria that made someone an apostle of Jesus Christ. One is, they had to be someone who had sat under the physical, earthly, historical teaching of Jesus in person. So the claim, if I were to stand up today and claim, by the way, I'm an apostle now, you'd know immediately that it was bogus. Because I didn't sit under Jesus' teaching. I couldn't even pretend to do that. And yet that was one really vital criteria that made somebody an apostle. Second one is that they had to actually literally be commissioned by Jesus. Jesus decides who his apostles are. The apostles don't. He determines that, yes, you are going to go out and represent me to the world. Closely related to that is they had to be given an understanding of Jesus' teaching through the influence, the supernatural influence of the Holy Spirit. All those passages we looked at for weeks about Jesus promising the coming of the Holy Spirit to bring to remembrance all that Jesus had taught them. And as I was saying at the time, I think that means more than just remembrance. It means real understanding, personal grasping of the teaching of Jesus and what it meant and what it implied. And then finally, and I think also important, is an apostle of Jesus Christ, just as Jesus himself, the Messiah, could do, could demonstrate his credentials as a Messiah by performing what Paul at one point calls the true signs of apostleship. And what he has in mind are supernatural acts that were signs of the authority that they had received from Jesus. That was the logic of the miracles that Jesus performed. Jesus said, I have the authority to forgive sins. Right, who's going to disprove that? Well, so that you might know that I have the authority to forgive sins, I say to you, he says to the lame man, rise, take up your bed and walk. And this man who's been paralyzed from birth, I think, stands up and walks. And his claim was, if I can make the claim to have the authority to heal people who are lame, then believe me too when I say I have been granted the authority to forgive sins. That's the structure, the logic behind the miracles that Jesus performed. It's an identical logic behind the miracles that the apostles performed. I claim to have the authority to speak for Jesus, to tell you what it is that the message he came to proclaim and deliver to the world. Anybody can make that claim, but I also claim to have the authority to make the blind see and the lame walk. If I can do that, then believe me when I say I have the authority to speak for Jesus. So that's the fourth very important credential as well. And all four of those would have to be present. Now, where we left off is, practically speaking, how did apostolic authority function? The Bible itself, of course, doesn't explore this in any kind of systematic way, but you glean a snapshot here and a snapshot here and there in the New Testament. Then you can kind of put the pieces together. And here's how I would put them all together. It seems to me that what was expected on all the apostles, and it makes sense when you understand who they are, what was expected on the part of all the apostles is that there would be unanimous agreement among them about what the gospel was, what the teaching of Jesus was, and what its implications were. They could agree on that. Now, that's a very reasonable assumption if they are who they claim to be. Namely, they are people who have heard the teaching of Jesus, but not only have they heard the teaching of Jesus, but by the Spirit of God himself, they have been guided into or led into a personal grasp of what that teaching was. They understand it. I mean, it's one thing for just any old teacher like me to teach a group of people and expect that you'll get the same story from everybody who heard me about what it was that Jack taught. I can verify from personal experience it doesn't happen. Some of my most alarming incidents in life, when I was preaching in California at PBC years and years and years ago, I'd preach my heart out, and somebody would come up after the service and say, Jack, I really, really got a lot out of this message. This was the best message I've ever heard in my life, especially when you said X. And the problem is the whole message was not X. I was teaching exactly the opposite. My point was exactly the opposite of what they were reporting back to me had blessed them so much. It sort of takes the wind out of your sails as a teacher. There's no guarantee that people are going to hear your teaching, that they're going to understand it, they're going to grasp it, that they're going to be in a position to really know what you're saying. What's remarkable about the apostles is that Jesus had promised them that the Spirit of truth is going to come. And when the Spirit of truth comes, he's going to lead you into a possession of an understanding of the wisdom that Jesus was imparting to the world. You are going to get it. Well, if truth is one and only one truth, if the message that Jesus came to deliver us is one and only one message, and all these men who are apostles get it, then it's got to be the same thing that they get. If it's not the same thing, then somebody didn't get it. So if this whole process of the Spirit of Truth coming into the world and preparing the apostles to be spokesmen for Jesus, if there's any validity to this at all, if it's working at all, and if it's true at all, then they're going to be in total and complete unanimity about what it was that Jesus was teaching. It sure appears to be, in the pages of the New Testament, that's what the apostles expected. There will be no disagreement among us. Well, so who gets to participate in this? I mean, the problem, of course, is who has to be unanimous? Well, the people who have to be unanimous are these people who fit these four criteria. They are the apostles of Jesus Christ, right down to the ability to perform miracles and show that they have been credentialed as apostles. Now, I don't know if I have made this clear yet, but it seems to me that we have at least 14 apostles. We have the 12, and I'm including Matthias, but no, is that right? You know, the one we never hear about. Who drew the lot? I mean, who got...
Matthias,
yeah, thank you. Including Matthias, you have the 12 apostles, but you also have Paul, who calls himself unmistakably an apostle of Jesus Christ, not just an apostle of some church. He's an apostle of Jesus Christ, called by Jesus himself, commissioned by him, and he defends his credentials as an apostle in his letters. And then it would appear pretty strongly that James, the brother of Jesus, was also counted among the apostles and was apparently so credentialed and so commissioned. So we have at least 14. We may have more. I don't know. But from the evidence in the New Testament, we have at least 14. It seems to me that those 14, plus maybe others that we are not aware of, were this community of apostles that would be in unanimous agreement about what the teaching of Jesus was, and would be in a position to function to arbitrate between conflicting ideas out there about what the Christian gospel is all about. And that it's their unanimous decision that I think was the arbiter in this first generation of Christians. What that means is that if any one of the recognized apostles had a substantial, unresolvable disagreement with one or more of the other apostles, then the whole thing's off. The whole thing's no good. All of this is bunk. That's sure the spirit of what Paul is arguing in the book of Galatians, because he says, I mean, that there was in fact a, what shall I call it, a turmoil, a problem that developed among the apostles real early on, and that was the whole issue of what about the Gentiles? Can the Gentiles be believers without becoming Jews, without becoming circumcised and keeping the law and so on? That became a really, really important issue among them. What's interesting is they resolved it unanimously. They sat down, they talked about things, they thought about what Jesus taught, they thought about what God was doing in the world, and they basically, in the Council of Jerusalem in chapter 15 of Acts, they kind of put up their hands and go, how can we deny the evidence? This, here's what Jesus taught, here are the implications of what he's taught, here's what Paul has told us God is doing out there in the world. It looks to us like there's absolutely no way in the world that we can conclude that God is not working among Gentiles as Gentiles. He just is. He's baptizing them and bringing them into a relationship with him. But they were unanimous about that. In the early stages of that, as the problem was developing, there was some lack of clarity. They had to come to clarity, but they got there, and they got there by remembering what Jesus taught and by understanding what Jesus taught in the light of all the evidence. That's how apostleship worked, it seems to me. One of the things to notice, I think, is that apostolic authority here is functioning informally. It's informal and it's dynamic, which is to say it's real, a real life authority in real life, rather than formal and institutionalized. We can make up for the lack of reality of something with a lot of ritual, with a lot of liturgy, with a lot of mumbo-jumbo, with really expensive clothing and crowns and staffs and smoke, incense. You know, you can create the air of heaviness, create the air of authority, create the weight and force of whatever with all these props. This is Hollywood authority. You make it look like, you give the illusion of authority, but there's nothing real about it. There's nothing really happening. What we see in the pages of the New Testament is real authority. These are people who really had a right to speak because they really understood, because they really had been inspired by the Spirit of Truth himself. and they could stand up and say, look, I was there, I heard Jesus teach, and I get it. And these 11 or 12 or 13 other people, they were there, they heard him teach, and they get it too. And part of the evidence that we all get it is, we're all very clearly in agreement on what it was that Jesus was teaching us. And the weight of their authority comes from the confidence of their understanding and the coherence of their view and the unanimity of their view. It's informal, but it's real. Now, in that regard then, why the big deal about the 12? Why did Peter feel compelled in chapter 1 to pick a replacement for Judas to fill out the 12? At that point, it sounds like that's going the other direction. We're going to formalize this thing. We're going to institutionalize this thing. We're going to make this we're going to form a constitution of the church and bylaws and make sure that we follow the bylaws and the whole nine yards. But what's interesting is you never see, is that true? With one possible exception, with the possible exception of the choosing the, what do they call deacons later, you never see the 12 functioning practically as the authority for the church. It's not like Paul had to come before the 12 and say, I've got a proposal to make. You guys have the authority to act on this. I read the bylaws last night, and I really can't act on my own. According to the bylaws, you guys have to pass this. Would you do this, please, so that I can get on with my mission to the Gentiles? It didn't work that way. There's no evidence that it worked that way. Paul felt completely and totally entitled to stand up before Peter and say, Peter, at Antioch, you are not being straightforward about the gospel in the way that you're behaving here. And Peter had to say, oops, you're right, I'm not. Because I know better than that. As an apostle who was taught and who understands and who gets it, you've caught me. I realize that I'm living inconsistently with the very message that I'm the spokesman for. Why did Paul have the authority to do that? Because he understood it and got it too. He understood the gospel. Never mind that he wasn't one of the 12. It didn't really make any difference. It was the message that was authoritative, not some funky role in some funky institution that they had created. It was the truth itself that had authority over their lives. So why the 12 then? It seems to me that the 12 apostles, in many respects, runs parallel to the 12 tribes of Israel. What's the significance of the 12 tribes of Israel? Not much, really. I mean, in the final analysis, the 12 tribes of Israel is more or less a symbol for the entirety of the physical seed of Abraham. The fact of the matter is, the 12 tribes of Israel is a rather loose sort of institution, if you want to call it that. The 12 tribes of Israel were made up of some tribes and some half-tribes, and you subtract one tribe here, multiply by 3 tribes, divide by 5 tribes, and add 100 tribes. I mean, it's a very patched together, not very neat and tidy reality. You have some people getting kicked out of Israel and other people being adopted into Israel. It just stands as a symbol, more or less, throughout the Bible, for the 12 tribes is the entirety of the physical seed of Abraham, of Jacob, of Israel. It's the entirety of that line that is represented by the 12 tribes. Therefore, all the promises that God made to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, and that were made to that physical seed, how can we represent that covenant that God made with this people? Well, it's a covenant that he made with the 12 tribes. It seems to me that the apostles represent, and they're called the foundation. Later in the New Testament, it talks about the foundation of the prophets and the apostles. In what sense is it foundational? The 12 apostles, I think, are simply a symbolic group, a figurehead group, that represent the entirety of the people of God, not in accordance with the old covenant or the covenant that God made with the physical seed of Abraham, but the covenant that God made, but the new covenant that God made. the new covenant that God made that pertains not just to the Jews, the physical seed, but to all the nations. Or if we look at it just in the context of Judaism, which is perhaps the right way to look at it, in the new covenant, you are not chosen by your physical descent, but you are chosen by the election of God. And so the apostles were simply chosen. They didn't inherit They didn't inherit their position in the 12 by lineage or anything of that sort. They were simply chosen by God. And what does that represent? I think it represents that to be a part of the physical seed of Abraham, you just need to be born of Abraham. But what about this new community? What about this community even among the Jews that are going to be the true children of Abraham according to this new covenant, this covenant in Jesus' blood? How do you belong to that community? You get chosen. You just get picked. And what's the symbolic foundation for that community? These 12 that were chosen by Jesus to represent him. Now, of course, there's an overlap, because the 12 also happened to all of them be apostles. But what I'm suggesting is that the 12 were a subset of the apostolic community. They were a symbolic figurehead group that functioned merely symbolically. Practically speaking, the real authoritative foundation of the church was the larger apostolic community that consisted of at least 14 and maybe more men. Seems to me that there's an important, just on the aside, seems to me that there's an important lesson in all of this. The significant divinely ordained roles in the church are not offices in the institution of some church. Rather, they are real, informal, and unofficial. It's the real and informal and unofficial exercise of influence and leadership in the community of believers, which results from possessing the authority of wisdom itself. Those are the significant divinely ordained roles. So just as the 12, you didn't have to be a member of the 12 in order to have a significant apostolic role. Paul was not one of the 12, but clearly he had a significant role in God's scheme of things. Correspondingly, I don't have to be a recognized leader in some church institution to have a significant divinely ordained role in the true invisible church. It's that perspective that makes me completely unconcerned about an issue like women being ordained. I mean, why on earth would we care? None of us should care to be ordained. I mean, it's not that there's anything particularly wrong with that. It's not that if we want to have an institution and we want to have positions in that institution and we want to grant them some kind of symbolic leadership and influence, okay, that's fine. But more often than not, if you've been in any churches, the real substantial leadership in a church may very well not be the institutional leadership of that church. Why? Because the people who have been chosen for the institutional leadership don't know what they're talking about. They simply don't have the wisdom. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the understanding. They have an entirely different agenda. And in fact, I think one of the tragic stories of modern Christian culture is that we have created an institution in the pastorate that attracts people who are ambitious. It attracts empire builders. It attracts people whose whole agenda in life is to be important in other people's lives. But they don't want to get there by becoming really important, by really having something to say. They want the glory and the honor and the prestige and the power that comes from having authority in an institution as a shortcut. But you and I ought to be driven by different motives. You and I have an entirely different agenda. My agenda should be, I want to understand, I want to know the truth, and I want to be able to serve other people by leading them into the truth, and whatever degree of influence that gives me is God's business, not mine. If he gives me influence, he gives me influence. If he doesn't give me influence, but he doesn't give me influence, and there's nothing I can do to change that. Influence comes from people being willing to hear, people being willing to listen, and I have no control over that. Only the Spirit of God can do that. But the only thing that matters to me is, God teach me. God make me one who understands. God make me one who has wisdom. Out of that kind of life, authority and influence may very well come. But if it comes, it comes. If it doesn't come, it doesn't come. That's entirely in God's hands. But we have a whole cultural network, a whole culture, a whole set of institutions that will dole out positions of power that are there for the taking if you really are ambitious and if you really want it. It's completely perverse. There couldn't be anything more unchristian and unbiblical than that. And that's what we fight for when we ask questions like, well, do we think women should be ordained? Translated, that question means, don't we think women should have as right to be as evilly ambitious as men can do? Well, I guess so. If you want to look at it that way, I guess so. But why would we look at it that way? Where are our values? Okay, I think that's enough on that. I want to... let's see. I don't know if I have time. Are there any questions on that? I mean, before we... Yeah, let's do this. Stephanie, let's do it. Maybe we'll get to chapter 2 next week.
Commenting on what you were saying about the unanimity between the apostles, I was remembering in Acts 15 the account of the church council of Jerusalem, and then also in Galatians 2 Paul's account of the same council.
Right.
And I was just wondering if you could comment on the slight discrepancy there, because I could see how
I don't think Galatians 2 is an account of the council of the Acts 15.
Okay.
I think it was a prior event. The thing that
Galatians,
I think, is written before the council that in Acts 15 even occurred, because otherwise it is just unthinkable, given the issue that Paul is addressing in Galatians, if it had already occurred that all of the apostles had got together and made this decision, why on earth does he not mention the decision? But he doesn't in Galatians. He talks about talking with the apostles and checking things out and making sure that they were on the same page. But he doesn't ever say, look, we had a council, folks, and all the apostles got together, including Peter, and we all decided that this was exactly what the truth dictated. But he doesn't have that available. I mean, I have to assume he doesn't have that available to him. Otherwise, it's unthinkable that he wouldn't mention it in the book of Galatians.
Because
it was exactly the issue that he was addressing in Galatians. So
it would go to show that they got together
informally.
I think it was he and Barnabas took from Antioch, took some money down. Was it money at that point? Yeah. No. They just transmitted the prophecy. I'd have to go back and look to Jerusalem at some point from the Antioch church, and he used that occasion, I think, to get together privately with some of the apostles and check things out. That's how I would read it.
Might seem esoteric, but you talked about one of the indicators being the ability to perform supernatural stuff. And what would be the difference between the supernatural stuff that the apostles were doing and some supernatural stuff that's happening that was more sinister prior to Pentecost with fortune tellers and demon stuff? And so what...
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. There seem to be two options. One option is that the authority of, if you have the authority of God, you have the authority to have your life intersect with God's supernatural acts that are truly supernatural acts. They're not tricks. They're not magicians, illusions. They're bona fide miracles. Whereas all the other stuff is somehow trickery and illusion, sleight of hand of some kind or another. I think that's possible. The reason I say that is because in 1 Thessalonians, in that passage we looked at, he talks about the man of lawlessness at the end of times doing what he calls false wonders. And it depends on what he means by false wonders there, how exactly we take that. Does it mean they weren't really supernatural that seems to me plausible, but that's one way to say it. The other one is that maybe they really are supernatural, but they are from the wrong source and are not really indicative of the activity of God, but some other activity. So that's the other option, is that maybe what we find is that Satan, demonic power, demonic influence is capable of a certain amount of supernatural phenomena. Either way, the thing that keeps us, either way, we have to be on our guard in that we mustn't just take the spectacular as prima facie evidence for the authority of God and the credentials of God. More has to go into divine credentials than being able to dazzle me with some kind of wondrous work. They also need to be shooting straight. And that's why, as I was saying a few weeks ago, that's why it's so critical that we become biblically literate and we know this stuff. We know from the record already before us what the true gospel really is. Because in the end, there are going to be a whole lot of biblically illiterate people who are going to see somebody come into the world doing amazing things, and they'll go, hey, he's from God, he's amazing. He's amazing, therefore he must be from God. Never are we invited to buy such a simplistic argument. He's amazing, he's from God. I quoted the thing out of Deuteronomy where Moses says, if someone should come to you and perform wondrous deeds, and I think he names some of the wondrous deeds, some pretty amazing things, and say to you, come follow other gods, stone them. That it's not enough that they dazzle me with their deeds, their seemingly supernatural deeds. They also need to be proclaiming a message that is utterly and completely continuous with the message that we've already received. If it contradicts this or leads us away from this, then all the supernatural signs in the world don't authenticate it. Because God doesn't change his mind. He simply adds to, elucidates, and expands on what he's already been talking about and on what he's already revealed. But this is a coherent revelation from beginning to end that's coherent. And that's what we need to be looking for. But if we're not equipped to judge whether it's coherent, then we're just sitting ducks. We're going to be an easy target. Did I have anything else?
I guess there's two parts to my... One's really a question, and one's just sort of a question.
Well, I know which way.
Well, it's sort of a wonder to me. I guess I'm being what I do for a living, I guess I wonder... How would a... I mean, I'm not sure you can answer this question, but that's why it's maybe not really a question. How would an apostle, like Matthias, for example, or James, I wonder what the experience would be like to come to the awareness that they were in fact an apostle. And do you have any ideas about that? I mean, the psychology. Is there anything that you're aware of in the scriptures that gives any kind of clue to that?
Give me some, for instance, I mean, what it could be this or it could
well,
be
maybe this. Maybe other people recognize it in them and said, you're an apostle. Or how would they, I mean, would they just start doing miracles? How would you know you could do it?
Yeah, I have the same question about Jesus. There's one point in Luke where Luke makes the comment that he uses the phrase, the Spirit was not present to perform miracles.
Right.
How embarrassing if you thought he was, but he wasn't. I just don't know. The psychology of that, I have no clue, never having been the Messiah or an apostle. It is interesting. The same thing with prophets. How did prophets know? I mean, they described things like the burden of the Lord came upon him, or the oracle of the Lord came to him. How do you know that kind of thing?
I guess part of my question is coming out of your discussion about how we think about church today and organization and all that stuff. And there's this whole phenomenon called referred to as a calling.
Right.
And
right.
I sort of believe in that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think I see where you're going. But it's the fact
that we don't have any clear picture
of what it would look like or what it would feel like or what the experience would be like to know that God is about to perform a miracle and so say, rise, take up your bed and walk, or know that you're receiving a revelation from God and so you can stand up and say, thus saith the Lord. Because that's not at all clear to us, we can make it up. And that's what's going on in our culture all along. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but Tony Arlen was telling me that he was watching Richard Roberts, is that the son? Yeah, Richard Roberts once on television. And you know, they, in their show, they have a belief that you receive what they call words of knowledge. So he was preaching, and at one point he stopped and went, oh, just a minute, finished preaching, and then went back to receive the word of knowledge from God. I don't think Isaiah did that. You know, if the burden of the Lord came upon you, you don't put God on hold and finish your conversation and then get back to God. It's blasphemous. It's incredible, incredible blasphemy. And yet we have so trivialized revelation, miracles. We have just absolutely trivialized them because we have made them into a natural, ordinary human phenomenon, as if it weren't an interruption into the ordinary and the mundane. One thing that's pretty clear to me, the prophets received things that were an interruption of their mundane lives. And the Messiah, when he could perform a miracle, or the apostle could perform a miracle, it was an interruption in their mundane lives. It was not at their discretion. You know, they weren't strutting down the road thinking, you know, my shadow's powerful. You know, just pass by my shadow. I've got a powerful shadow. I mean, that's just unthinkable. That's crazy. They recognized that all of these acts were not their acts. They were the act of God that was being correlated with their life and ministry. It wasn't some power that they possessed, not even a power that God had given them. Jesus himself insists with respect to his miracles, I'm not doing this stuff. God is credentialing me by performing miracles. I'm not performing the miracles. The deeds that I do not do. My Father does them. The words that I speak, I do not speak. My Father has given them to me. He wasn't even speaking out of his own wisdom. He didn't figure this out. He knew that he was being given the words from God. Well, I'm sure the apostles' experience was exactly the same. In that one I was alluding to, remember that event that we'll get into in Acts where Peter is literally just walking down the street and whenever his shadow falls on somebody, they're healed. Well, that didn't happen ever, we don't have any record of that ever happening before that, and it never happened again. It was just this one weird occasion where God used the casting of his shadow to be the occasion upon which God acted and acted powerfully to heal people. Why did he do that? He just wanted to send the message loud and clear at that particular event, this guy's an apostle, listen to him. He has the authority to speak for me.
Jonah wasn't very willing to
participate in
what he's got on him
for
that one case.
How so? Expand on that. I mean, but he was saying that Jonah was not a particularly willing prophet.
Well, when he found out that God wanted him to go to Nineveh, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That he took a boat to the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
And when he ended up back in Nineveh, he was not happy about the message he had to give.
Right.
And he also was looking forward to God destroying Nineveh, of which had been evidently prophesied before, but he wanted to take place then, not while he was in bringing people to the Lord.
It turns out to be a Nintendo kid.
Right. There is that matter in the tree, or in the desert. And, you know, and that's pretty good evidence of our optimism as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing is that the modern climate suggests it's our mere availability and willingness to God that allows the Spirit of God to flow through us and empower us and make us do dazzling and wonderful things. And I think the point you're making is that God isn't exactly confined to the willing. He'll move the unwilling if he chooses to. Bill, and then Andrew, and then we've got to quit.
Regarding Larry's question about how James knew he was an apostle, one of Jesus' appearances after the resurrection mentioned in 1 Corinthians was to James.
Right.
And I think it's likely a commissioning took place then.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I concluded. In 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about, and he appeared to James. And he doesn't elaborate on that, but given the way James gets treated as an apostle, I have to conclude that appearance was Jesus commissioning him in much the same way that he commissioned Paul after the fact. Good. Andrew, here.
I've been studying through John 14, and I was looking at the passage about greater works than these shall be do. And that passage seems just right for what you're talking about coming up with. But he doesn't go into exactly what works we're talking about. Seems like today, ever since then, people have been coming with all kinds of different works. You may have covered this passage when we weren't here.
Yeah.
Could you briefly comment on
just what I think the greater works is referring to? Basically, to boil it down, to simplify it, Jesus proclaimed the coming of the kingdom of God. People didn't understand him, they didn't believe him, and they crucified him. The apostles came proclaiming exactly the same message, and thousands of people responded positively and believed them, and unto their own salvation. That was a greater work than Jesus performed. And he said, he ties it to the coming of the Spirit of Truth. That's why they could perform this greater work, because during Jesus' ministry, he was a prophet from God revealing the truth, but God had not yet poured out the Spirit of Truth on the nations. So people were deaf to it. They didn't hear it. They didn't get it, except for just, a handful, and even they only barely grasped it and vaguely grasped it. But after Pentecost, the Spirit of Truth is poured out, and people's ears are open, and all of a sudden the same message that they heard from Jesus a couple of years back, all of a sudden they go, oh, why didn't anybody ever tell me? This is the truth. I think that's the greater work. I'll close with this. Along those lines, what I think, one of the things that struck me about this event that we're about to read about in Acts 2, where the Spirit is poured out, the tongues of the flames of fire are dancing over their heads, there's this sound of a mighty rushing wind in the room where they're in the upper room where they're all gathered, and then it says in verse 4, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other languages as the Spirit was giving them utterance. And the question I ask myself is, as the Spirit was giving them utterance, what exactly is he describing here? Is he saying that the Spirit came and gave them the supernatural ability to speak in another language? He did do that clearly, as we will see, but is that what he means by as the Spirit himself gave them utterance? I don't think so. The more I thought about it, what it sounds like he's saying is the lights went on. Now, I mentioned they've been gathered preparing themselves for this day, just as Jesus had commanded them to do, basically hanging out in the upper room and I think, among other things, talking with one another. What did Isaiah mean here? What did Joel mean here? What, studying their Bible and discussing it, trying to sort it all out. At this point in time, the Spirit of God comes upon them, and I think all of a sudden, some pieces fall into place. They have something to say. You know what Isaiah meant? Do you know what Joel meant here? Do you know what so-and-so was saying here? Do you know what this psalm is talking about? Do you know what this psalm is talking about? So I expect that if we could have recorded it with a whole battery of UN translators to transcribe it for us and interpret it for us, what's the content of what it is that they were uttering on this day? I imagine it was, here's what David said in the psalm, and here's what this meant. Here's what Isaiah was saying, and here's what that meant. Here's what Joel was saying, and here's what that meant, and so on. I think just all of a sudden there was this incredible cascade of understanding that came upon them. And in a way, that would have been the most remarkable and wondrous aspect of this whole event, is that the stuff that they've been striving, groping for a number of days now, 30 days now, all of a sudden it's all falling in place. And if any of you who've ever had the experience of studying the Bible and working hard at it and just being completely confounded and you can't figure it out, and all of a sudden the light goes on, and the joy and the wonder and the delight that is, I think that's what they're experiencing here. And that the Spirit is giving them utterance. That is, the Spirit of truth has come in and given them a grasp and understanding of what this is all about, and out of that they speak. And I'll get into this next week, but they knew what they were saying, I would contend. This gift of speaking another language is not speaking in another language something that I don't understand. The gift of speaking in another language is saying something intelligible. I know exactly what I'm trying to say, but it's as if in the midst of me saying exactly what I'm trying to say, except more language like than that. I say it in French or German or Greek or Japanese or Chinese. I know what I'm saying, but all of a sudden what's being formed out of my mouth is the content of what I'm saying in the language of somebody else, not in my own language. So as the Spirit gave them utterance, they were speaking the truth, but this remarkable thing happened. I stopped saying it I stopped articulating it in a way that corresponded to my language, and I began articulating it in a way that corresponded to somebody else's language who spoke an entirely different language, and they go, "Man, I thought he was a Galilean. That's awfully good Cretan that he's speaking. Wow, his Arabic is excellent. Where'd that come from?" And they start scratching their heads going, "This is weird. Tell me what this all means." We'll talk about that.